KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's Department of Commerce recently awarded more than $300,000 in grants to Native-owned businesses across the state. The funds aim to support the economic development of tribal communities while supporting small businesses. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Traxler has more.
George Brown of Dodson and member of the Little Shell Chippewa Tribe is among 25 business owners set to receive grants from the state. Brown operates a small cafe, store, and meat processing facility with his wife, Sherry. The Milk River Meats and Eats is slated to receive $14,000 for new meat processing equipment. Brown says the money is a lifesaver.
Oh, it means a pile. I mean, things are so expensive this day and age that any help you can get to cover the main cost is going to make things work a lot better.
The funding stems from the state's Indian Equity Fund Small Business Grant Program and goes to a variety of industries. Grant funds will support Brown's meat processing as well as agriculture, retail, restaurants, and construction businesses. Mackenzie Espeland is an administrator with the Department of Commerce.
So supporting Native American-owned businesses really empowers the communities all across the state, and it strengthens those tribal economies.
She explained the grants create a ripple effect in their communities by stimulating growth and creating job opportunities. This year, the program's $320,000 will support business owners like George Brown. In Missoula, I'm Victoria Traxler.
Last week, a lawsuit from a pair of tribes challenging a power line project in southern Arizona, previously thrown out by a Tucson federal judge, has been remanded back to a lower court. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Plaintiffs allege the Interior Department illegally granted permits, greenlighting construction of the SunZia transmission line, which broke ground in 2023. The 550-mile route through Arizona and New Mexico crosses over the San Pedro River Valley, a region of significance to Apaches and Ossums.
Certainly for this project, and probably never again, at least in the Ninth Circuit, is a federal agency going to be able to pretend that a project doesn't have those landscape altering effects.
John Welch is with the nonprofit Archaeology Southwest, one of four plaintiffs, including the Center for Biological Diversity, Fauna Offa Nation, and San Carlos Apache Tribe.
This is a very, very strong appellate decision, a big thumb on the scales of justice in favor of the plaintiffs. And so it's not just procedural. They're going to have to consult in much better faith than the BLM did on this project.
An appeals panel found plaintiffs presented enough evidence that the agency violated the National Historic Preservation Act. Still, this latest ruling doesn't mean construction of SunZia will stop, nor that the tribes will win their legal battle to remove the lines. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs is urging for immediate assistance, including housing for evacuees as wildfires burn in northern Manitoba. According to Manitoba First Nations leaders, thousands of First Nations people are seeking refuge, with many arriving in Winnipeg and other locations with nowhere to go and limited access to necessities. And they say current shelters are overcrowded and inadequate and are asking for hotels and other accommodations in Winnipeg and across the province to help displaced families. Leaders are urging the province for immediate assistance. The province has declared a state of emergency. Leaders say those in need of a place to stay include elders, children, and individuals with serious medical conditions. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs Strauss Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The Secretary of Interior should be here all the time, every day, because it's such a big part of the portfolio.
Members of President Trump's cabinet visit Alaska to promote resource development. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, in a first-of-its-kind project, an Anchorage professor maps wildfire risk for rural Alaska.
So our maps can tell us places where they're most at risk for fire and take the actions to reduce them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Three high-level Trump administration officials are in Alaska this week to make good on a day-one promise from the president to unleash Alaska's resource potential. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, Energy Secretary Chris Wright, and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin are part of a group touring Prudhoe Bay today, along with Governor Mike Dunleavy and Senator Dan Sullivan. Yesterday, with Senator Lisa Murkowski, they took part in a roundtable with industry leaders to discuss making it easier to develop resources in the state. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early is on the tour today and joins me now. Wesley, a significant portion of the president's cabinet is in Alaska this week and on the North Slope today. Why are they here?
Well, President Trump signed an executive order on his first day that was titled Unleashing Alaska's Extraordinary Resource Potential, and it aims to maximize current energy output in the state and specifically mentions the exporting of liquefied natural gas. So with the spotlight on the state, officials said they're here to figure out what's standing in the way of development from Alaskans. I posed a question to EPA Administrator Zeldin, essentially asking, what can you learn from being here that you couldn't learn in a PowerPoint? And his response was that he really valued the first-person opportunity to witness these communities. He described at least one Alaska community along the North Slope as comparable to a, quote, third-world country, like ones he witnessed during his military service. And he believes that developing the region's natural resources can help to lift those communities up.
So talking to folks on the ground, what are the Trump officials and the Alaska leaders hearing from companies or other stakeholders about what's standing in the way of development on the North Slope?
Most of their remarks that they sort of gleaned from the roundtables that they did were made during a rally that was held in support of North Slope workers. And the officials raised a number of topics that are pretty well-worn in Alaska, things like the Ambler Road, the King Cove Road, building the LNG pipeline. But they didn't really have any specifics as to how to actually speed up that process to get those things approved.
And those are definitely things we've heard about before. Did they announce any significant news today?
No big news, but there was an announcement out of the Interior Department this morning that they're working to reverse a series of Biden-era restrictions on development in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, also known as NPRA. That got a pretty big applause from the crowd, but it's not really a surprise. A reconciliation bill from House Republicans actually said that the government should ignore the Biden NPRA restrictions, so it's been a key priority for Republicans. Burgum himself already called to reopen up to 82% of the area for development last month. They were pretty cagey on some other big Alaska development projects. Zeldin was asked directly if he supported the Pebble Mine, and he had, quote, no news on the subject, but he said his officials are consulting with people on both sides of the issue. Much of the events today felt like a listening tour, you know, a chance for the officials to get an Alaska perspective without delivering anything concrete.
Gotcha. Well, were there any moments from the Prudhoe Bay tour that stood out?
Yeah, I think the various foreign business and government officials added a different dynamic to this tour. Actually, on my flight this morning, there were a whole bunch of people from Taiwan. There were delegates from Japan, South Korea, the Philippines. And the ones that I spoke to at that rally seemed pretty intrigued at the prospect of the AKLNG project. They're not so intrigued that they could say whether their business or government would commit to supporting the project, mind you. But the idea of buying LNG from a nearby country that already has gas flowing and not from countries the administration officials and Senator Sullivan described as America's adversaries, you know, countries like China, Russia, you know, it seemed like something they're at least considering. And I think we can expect a lot more of those conversations to play out during the governor's sustainable energy conference that he's holding in Anchorage this week.
Okay, well, we will stay tuned. That was Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early on the North Slope. Wesley, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Amid serious conservation concerns, Yukon River communities are heading into another summer of near total salmon fishing closures. And as KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, it doesn't look like the situation will improve in the near future.
Aside from a possible brief opening to harvest summer chum salmon, 2025 will be the sixth consecutive year of total salmon fishing closures on the Yukon River. Beginning June 1st, the first of a series of rolling salmon fishing closures will go into effect on the lower Yukon. The closures will then work their way upriver, following Chinook and summer chum salmon on their journey toward the Canadian border. As in recent years, residents will be able to harvest non-salmon fish using 4-inch set nets, considered small enough to avoid catching salmon, but not totally able to avoid incidental catch. But even those nets will be limited for periods of the summer. Yukon River Federal In-Season Manager Holly Carroll explained in a public hearing hosted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in May that a 2-week complete gillnet closure put in place last year to protect Chinook will likely be extended.
Chinook harvest in some areas did still increase. And so for this year, we think a 3-week closure at the height of the Chinook run, time to move upriver with the Chinook, would better protect them and might reduce some of that incidental harvest that's still occurring in those 4-inch gill nets.
According to Carroll, the 4-inch set nets used to harvest non-salmon will also be limited in the later part of the season to protect fall chum and coho runs. Beginning July 16th, fisheries managers plan to limit their use to a 3-day weekend schedule. As part of the recent hearing, residents of communities along hundreds of miles of river shared about the loss of culture and economic hardship faced as a result of the salmon closures, as well as the health issues that come with an increasing reliance on non-native foods. And the restrictions reach far beyond the mouth of the Yukon River. Residents of Hooper Bay and Chivac, more than 100 miles away, echoed many of the same concerns as Yukon communities, but also expressed doubts that their coastal harvests were directly impacting the river's stocks. Carroll explained that ocean harvests of Chinook by the coastal communities have historically been small. She said more research is needed to understand run composition, but that tagging studies have shown the restrictions are biologically justified.
The truth is that the entire Yukon area, all the fish passing that area, are very likely to be Yukon-oriented because of the timing of them coming past your villages. They're unlikely to be completely Kuskokwim or completely Norton Sound. So we have to protect them.
Overall, the total Yukon River Chinook run is projected to be roughly 72,000 fish. Just 30,000 of these are expected to make it across the Canadian border, where an international agreement was signed last year to completely suspend the harvest of Yukon River Chinook salmon for 7 years. The fall chum salmon run and much smaller coho salmon run are also projected to fall well below what managers consider a harvestable surplus. In 2024, both species saw their third lowest returns on record. The summer chum run, a small bright spot for some Yukon River communities in recent years, is likely to meet the upper end of escapement goals. If opened, harvest would be limited to less efficient, selective gear like dip nets that allow Chinook to be released alive. But federal and state fisheries managers, who together manage the river in a patchwork, have agreed on a cautious approach due to low run sizes in the years when the fish's parents spawned. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, emotions pour out as the Aleutic Museum reopens in Kodiak.
It has been tears of joy tonight. My heart is full, and I feel like my soul is singing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It doesn't matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, or what you agreed to in the past. Sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through multiple resources. Visit notaloneak.org to find help for yourself or a loved one. Remember, it's not your fault. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The driver in a fatal Seward Highway crash over the weekend now faces charges of manslaughter and driving under the influence. Police say 911 callers reported that 23-year-old Wyatt Flotra's sedan was headed south at speeds above 100 miles per hour early Saturday before it crashed just north of Girdwood around 4 a.m. The passenger, 20-year-old Eamon Johnston, died at the scene. According to a charging document, Flotra told police he had looked at his phone just before he lost control of the car, and it flew 40 feet onto nearby railroad tracks. He also allegedly admitted to drinking before the crash. Police obtained a warrant for a sample of Flotra's blood, which showed that he was above Alaska's legal alcohol limit for driving. Flotra made an initial court appearance in the case Sunday morning. In the past 3 days in Anchorage, two pedestrians have been struck and wounded by drivers along the same busy Midtown Boulevard. Police say a pedestrian was critically injured today at Benson Boulevard and C Street. The collision shortly before noon led police to temporarily close part of the intersection. Police had no additional information to share by midday. Just 2 days earlier and a few blocks to the east, police say another pedestrian was hit by a driver at Benson's intersection with the Seward Highway. Police say that pedestrian suffered life-threatening injuries early Saturday morning and was still being treated at a local hospital today. Investigators are still seeking the driver and vehicle involved. So far this year, drivers in Alaska's largest city have fatally struck seven pedestrians. One of them, a man who died April 1st, was struck at the same site as Saturday's hit and run. Businesses do not like uncertainty, but many in Southeast Alaska say that's exactly what they're facing amid recent actions by the federal government. And that's driving down local business owners' optimism about their economic prospects. That's according to a report released last week by the Southeast Alaska Business Climate Survey. It included insight from more than 400 business leaders from throughout the region. Melanie Shivens is the owner of Raincoast Data, which conducts the annual survey.
Anytime you put the words uncertainty and business together, it's not a recipe for success.
The survey shows that almost half of the businesses that participated expect recent federal actions to negatively impact their operations. Those actions include the Trump administration's funding and job cuts, executive orders, and tariffs. Timber, arts, and manufacturing businesses were reportedly the most concerned. Shivens says both business confidence and economic optimism have also appeared to shrink compared to previous years, and that worries her.
We've seen a big shift in how people view the economy in a short period of time, which has been really interesting, really fascinating, and it's definitely not the positive outlook that we're looking for.
Tourism industry leaders shared concerns that tariffs might stop people from traveling or participating in tours. They're also worried about increasing costs and decreasing availability of goods, such as parts for helicopters. Housing availability was also an important topic in the report. Nearly 80% of employers reported that housing issues directly cause turnover or deter potential hires from moving to the region. The study says that's most problematic in Juneau and Sitka, where affordable and workforce housing is particularly scarce. A new app mapping wildfire risk in Bristol Bay is filling in major information gaps just in time for what officials warn could be a dangerous fire season. The map is the first of its kind in rural Alaska and comes in response to an extreme spike in wildfires in Bristol Bay over the past 3 years. KDLG's Margaret Sutherland reports.
The Alaska Venture Fund is a nonprofit that works with regional stakeholders on wildfire preparedness in Bristol Bay. After a severe fire season in 2022, the group hired University of Alaska Anchorage Associate Professor Jennifer Schmidt to create a wildfire risk map as part of a larger effort to build community wildfire protection plans in the region. Schmidt has developed similar wildfire risk maps in Anchorage and the interior, but she says this is the first time the approach has been applied to rural Alaska.
I built an app for the Bristol Bay area where people can visualize what this wildfire directionality looks like, what the exposure looks like. That way people can zoom in on their houses and they can see if they have a problem, don't have a problem, do I need to take action.
Schmidt originally planned to map the communities of Dillingham and Igiagig. While she was at it, she mapped 24 communities in Bristol Bay and created an app for public use. It's the first detailed and community-informed wildfire exposure and hazardous fuels map in Bristol Bay, and it provides a new data set and insight for the region. While there is a national wildfire risk map, Schmidt says it is largely inaccurate for much of Alaska.
The unfortunate thing is it, you know, shows that Alaska has low wildfire risk. So communities go for grants and they get shot down because these national products don't accurately reflect local conditions.
She started with mapping vegetation and ranking each type by flammability on a 100-point scale, 1 being least flammable and a low-risk area, 100 being most flammable and a high-risk area. Schmidt says spruce and grass are ranked amongst the highest risk fuels in Bristol Bay. Unlike most regions she's worked in, grass fuels many Bristol Bay fires. So she adjusted her rankings to match that. She says having community-informed input is essential for accuracy.
Part of the process is getting this information into the hands of people so that they can see the products and then in turn tell me, yes, this works, no, this doesn't work, can you add this?
Once the area was mapped with vegetation type and flammability, she overlaid it with infrastructure like private residences, schools, and the hospital. She also collaborated with local stakeholders to identify specific areas that are important, like boatyards and fuel tanks.
So our maps can tell us places where they're most at risk for fire and take the actions to reduce that.
This information is becoming more crucial. In 2022, Bristol Bay saw a 7,500% increase in acres burned, according to a presentation by the Alaska Venture Fund. Scott Renzo is the fire department coordinator for the city of Dillingham. He says that's partly due to changing environmental conditions in the region.
There's always been fires, but now these fires are larger because it's drier. There's more vegetation. There's more fuel loads. When you have a fire, it has a real potential to be a big fire. As I think in the past, historically, there would be smaller fires, but not the large size fires we're seeing recently.
After a low snowfall winter, Renzo says the region is bracing for what could be another risky wildfire season this summer. The new map is a key tool in their planning. And he says it can be used to help community members see if their residences are in a high-risk area. But he says taking action to harden the home can happen whether or not a home is in a high-risk area. It includes simple things, like keeping wood piles away from structures and keeping the grass mowed. Schmidt's final report for the communities of Dillingham and Aleknagik will be presented at the end of the year. For the 22 other communities included in her map, the information is there to be used if and when they need it. Reporting from KDLG in Dillingham, I'm Margaret Sutherland.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
After 8 years on the job, Chancellor Dan White is retiring from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. An announcement late Friday says he'll be leaving at the end of July. In spite of cuts in research funds, he says the institution is stable and well-positioned. KUAC's Robin has more.
Dan White was hired in 1995 as a professor of civil and environmental engineering. He took over as chancellor in 2017. In an interview Sunday afternoon, he said That's enough.
This will wrap up 30 continuous years at UAF and as 8 years as chancellor. I felt like it was time for me, and also the university is in a really good spot.
8 years is about twice the national average for a college chancellor. During that time, White has dealt with some pressures and trials, such as Governor Mike Dunleavy's drastic statewide funding cuts in 2019, then shifting to entirely online classes during the COVID pandemic in 2020, and other challenges since then.
You know, really important to me was not to leave the institution at a time when it was in distress.
White's administration has a list of accomplishments he's proud of.
Had growing enrollment for the last 4 years. While across the nation, universities are seeing declining enrollment, UAF is growing. We doubled the amount of research.
And he's been a champion of having UAF recognized as what's called an R1 university, in the top tier for research institutions. That means international prestige, but it could be a heavy lift as it requires attracting and graduating more doctorates.
The institution really is an R1 institution, and I think we just are smaller academically, but we're getting there and over the hill of 70 PhDs per year.
He said recent turmoil with federal cutbacks and eliminating diversity language didn't factor in his decision to leave.
The board had their motion and we made the changes, but we continue to support all students and we continue to be a place of belonging.
UAF is the state's scientific and academic research hub. White ticked off Arctic security, understanding the environment, engineering, geophysics, fisheries, and hibernation medical research. The Fairbanks and Alaska Chambers of Commerce call it an economic engine for the state. White says UAF spends about $500 million a year, mostly in Fairbanks.
I don't want to be Pollyanna about the strength of the institution, but it is nationally well-positioned, and I think that's important to remember. We don't know exactly how the federal landscape will shake out with respect to research. We know that research will continue to be needed by the country. It'll continue to be needed by the world.
White has overseen some initiatives that are still being crafted that others will finish after he leaves.
I really want to see Trathieta Indigenous Studies Center be built. We are on the cusp of our new childcare facility, which has been a real push over the last 6-7 years. We are talking about new housing in the next 3 to 5 years. And I just look forward to being able to watch from the sidelines and see those get done.
Dan White is known for wearing a Nanox ball cap everywhere he goes, even while dressed in a suit. It's a symbol of his support for the university.
How could you not be a cheerleader for UAF? It's an amazing institution full of amazing people with an amazing community that supports it. I have also found that a ball cap makes you more approachable. You know, what things am I proud about? I'm proud because I think I've been an approachable chancellor and I've gotten to know lots of really awesome people.
White's wife also recently retired. He has a daughter who is attending UAF, so he plans to stay connected. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
The University of Alaska Southeast hired 2 new administrators. One will lead its School of Education and the other will oversee the campus in Sitka. Carly Simon is the new dean of the UAS School of Education. She's worked as the school's interim dean since 2023 and led its accreditation efforts, according to a news release from UAS. The campus appointed her as the permanent dean last December. Simon says she's excited to work with faculty on larger projects. This includes developing a new Masters of Teaching program with a specialty on Indigenous languages and teaching apprenticeships.
I think everybody feels that they can kind of settle in and start working on the big efforts and initiatives that we've been wanting to get to, but have been waiting for the stability and leadership.
UAS also hired Jeremy Rupp as the new Sitka campus director. He's replacing the previous director who retired earlier this year. As director, he will oversee the day-to-day operations of the Sitka campus.
This position is meant to support the really important work that others are doing. And it's a community campus, and that means that it's really meant to support the community.
Rupp started the position about a month ago and says he's looking forward to being a part of the local community. Well, the Aleutic Museum is finally open after a nearly 2-year closure to about double its public space, just in time to celebrate its 30th anniversary. KMXT's Brian Venois was at the grand opening.
Aleutic dancers could be heard throughout the museum. They sang and danced as the crowd filled the new event space and checked out exhibits. Wook is one of the dancers.
Since we were so spread apart our villages, it's a little bit harder. So seeing all the effort that was put into bringing the museum together again, all the dancers together, it's been really awesome.
They split their time between Kodiak and Yuzinki, one of the villages on the northern end of the archipelago, home to about 100 people. Wook says they were happy to see how things have changed since the last time they got a tour.
The exhibits before were amazing. I loved them. I would walk through and just so amazed at everything I saw. But now, it's like an explosion of like different kinds of art.
That was the general sentiment of the grand reopening. The Aleutic Museum nearly doubled its exhibit space as part of a $14 million construction project. It used to have 400 objects and art pieces displayed before it closed. Now that construction's complete, almost 700 items are on display with some extra breathing room to take it all in. Wook felt a wave of excitement as they walked the halls.
I've seen I think there was 5 otkuk in there, which is like our clothing parkas, and that was just, it's so awesome. Like, for a long time, I didn't even know some of the things that we've had in there, but yeah, it's a whole different world is what it feels like now.
The museum board's president, Lorena Skonberg, felt the same way.
The Aleutic culture, when I was growing up, we weren't really sure. It was sort of the beginning of the period of revival, and now it's like people know what Aleutics are. We're Aleutic people. You know, we come from Kodiak Island Archipelago. You know, we identify with our villages.
Skonberg says having their culture honored and displayed like this is huge. There's a whole section of the museum that shows how Aleutic culture is still celebrated and passed down. Shauna Hegna is another board member.
You know, when I grew up in Port Lyons, we dreamed of a time when we could see all of our youth dancing and our elders speaking our language. And this generation, my children's generation, are realizing that.
She says she's proud of the museum's role in that work.
Some would say the day that the doors opened, the museum was already too small. We just have so many artifacts and pieces of our living culture to share with the public and the community. And it feels like they finally have a home that's deserving of the magnitude.
And the reopening is just the start. While Hegna is wrapping up her time on the board, she's excited to see how the museum continues to help keep Aleutic culture alive.
Well, it has been tears of joy tonight. My heart is full, and I feel like my soul is singing. I'm sorry. This is so incredible. There were hundreds of people who gave their personal time, their personal resources, they volunteer to be able to celebrate our living culture, not only in Kodiak and in our villages, but with visitors from around the world. And that's incredible.
Touring the new exhibits, I'm Brian Venwa.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Dead Horse, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Chris Clint in Anchorage, Clarice Larson and Jamie Deep in Juneau, Margaret Sutherland in Dillingham, Robin in Fairbanks, and Brian Venwa in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media. What else should
performer. Our favorite performer, isn't it? All of ours? You like him the best? Oh, yeah, this guy representing the Lead Belly Estate wants to sell me Lead Belly's guitar for $500,000.
Passing a basket, man.
Yeah. I even asked David Geffen personally if he'd buy it for me. He wouldn't do it.
Finally, I figured out. Long, long time. Now there's a turnabout, maybe cause I'm trying. There's been times, all my road, just can't turn and walk away. Wondering if I'm lying. There's been times
I'm so confused.
All my road
leave you.
Just can't turn
and walk away.
Let's go, girls. Come on. I'm going out tonight. I'm feeling all right. Gonna let it all hang out. Wanna make some noise. Really raise my voice. Yeah, I wanna scream and shout. Best thing about being a woman.
like a woman. Becoming clearer. I don't wanna waste another day stuck in the shadow of my mistakes. Yeah, 'cause I want you and I feel you crawling underneath my skin like a hunger, like a burning to find a place I've never been. Now I'm broken and I'm faded. I'm half the you can have what's left of me. I've been dying inside, little by little, nowhere to go, but going out of my mind. In endless circles, running from myself.
Come on, here we go. You ain't, you gotta let them know. A black woman, time I hear a brother call a girl a bitch or a hoe, trying to make a sister feel low. You know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring breath to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block, I had my cutoff shorts on, right? Cause it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break fly. I punched him dead in his eyes, said,
who you crawling with, bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y. Days at work give you an attitude and you erupt. And take it out on me, but that's about enough. You put your hands on me again, I put your ass in handcuffs. I guess I fell so deep in love, I grew dependency. I was too blind to see just how it was affecting me. All that I knew is you was all the man I had. And I was scared to let you go, even though you treated me bad. But I don't wanna see my kids see me getting beat down by daddy smacking mommy all around. You say I'm nothing without you, but I'm nothing with you. A man don't really love you if he hits you. Yeah. This is my notice to the tool, I'm not taking it no more. I'm not your personal whore, that's not what I'm here for. Ain't nothing good don't come to you till you do right by me. Brother, you ain't sitting in the
bitch.
Now that you saw Apache's video, I saw you wildin', acting like a fool. I peeped you out the window, jumping girls after school. But where did all of this come from? A minute ago, you was a nerd and nobody ever heard of you. Now you would wanna be hard. You barely know your ABC. Please. There's plenty of people out there with triggers ready to pull it. Why you trying to jump in front of the bullet, young lady? And real bad girls are the silent type.
Yeah.
Ain't none of this worth getting your face sliced. Cause that's what happened to your homegirl, right?
With no
she
bite.
Got to wear that for life. Who you calling?